What if everything you believed about American success was a carefully constructed lie? For decades, Donald Trump stood as the ultimate symbol of self-made triumph, the brash dealmaker who turned ambition into billions, who bounced back from every setback, who proved that anyone could make it in America. Oprah praised his book, millions watched his reality show, even Warren Buffett marveled at his resilience. But what happens when you peel back the gold leaf and discover the foundation was never his to build? The Trump story isn't about bootstraps and grit. It's about inheritance and illusion, about a son who spent 50 years spending his father's fortune while convincing the world he'd created his own. Understanding this deception matters because we've elevated the performance over the reality, mistaking celebrity for competence, confusing noise for substance. The question isn't just how Trump fooled America, it's why we wanted so badly to believe. Before Donald, there was Fred, and the contrast couldn't be starker. Fred Trump embodied the methodical immigrant work ethic that actually built New York. 12-hour days on construction sites, financial records kept in his pocket, collecting bent nails to save pennies. He earned the nickname Henry Ford of the building industry through relentless execution, never announcing projects until financing was secured. Fred's empire rose from government housing programs after the Depression and World War II. When military installations around Hampton Roads, Virginia, exploded during the war, Fred pivoted instantly, securing government-backed loans covering 90% of construction costs. Here's where it gets interesting. Developers weren't required to document actual expenses or return unspent mortgage funds. His Shorehaven and Beachhaven complexes generated $5.5 million in profit before a single tenant moved in. When the 1954 FHA scandal exposed these practices, newspapers portrayed Fred as pocketing nearly $4 million in windfall profits. The Department of Justice called his cost estimates false and lies. Yet Fred faced no consequences. The FHA admitted they were just giving the stuff away. A family pattern emerged. Work the system, exploit loopholes, use connections to avoid accountability. By the 1950s, Fred began grooming a successor, focusing on Donald with laser intensity. Despite being the strongest student, daughter Marianne wasn't under consideration. Young Donald developed a troubling mean streak, cannonballing into the pool to soak arriving families, treating younger brother Robert as if he were mentally deficient. By 13, his behavior had become unmanageable enough that Fred sent him to New York Military Academy, not as punishment, but as training. The Academy's rigid hierarchy suited Donald perfectly. Reveille at 6 a.m., uniform inspections, constant marching. By senior year, he rose to captain of Company A, leading with detachment, locking himself in his room after dinner, delegating discipline to subordinates. Fellow cadets believed Fred's wealth influenced decisions, particularly when Donald was unexpectedly placed at the front of the Columbus Day Parade. The Academy taught Trump to command attention while maintaining a carefully crafted persona. His pattern of exaggerating accomplishments began here, borrowing medals for yearbook photos, later claiming athletic prowess despite poor statistics. He learned that perception mattered more than reality, that confidence could substitute for competence. At 22, Donald lived at home, commuting to Fred's Brooklyn office with an impressive title and $100,000 salary, but finding rental management tedious. His first independent venture came in 1969, investing $70,000 of Fred's money in Paris Is Out. The comedy closed after 100 performances. Undeterred, he moved to Manhattan's Upper East Side, rebranding the Fred Trump Organization to the Trump Organization, placing himself at the center while erasing his father from public view. Fred showed financial favoritism, giving Donald 25% ownership in an East Orange senior housing project his siblings didn't receive, plus $48,000 annually to manage the building, though Fred's employees did actual work. In January 1973, a New York Times profile presented Donald as company president with numerous falsehoods, claiming he graduated first at Wharton, that the company was buying Manhattan property, and that Donald was the only Trump child interested in real estate. Unlike Fred, who rarely made false claims despite immodesty, Donald established a pattern of embellishment. Donald's Manhattan entry coincided with New York's mid-1970s financial crisis. His first target? The decrepit Commodore Hotel near Grand Central, now occupied by homeless people, rats, and prostitutes. Though officials dismissed him as a twerp, connections with Mayor Beam's administration gave him access. Trump boldly requested the city eliminate property taxes. Despite opposition, Beam approved. Instead of paying $4 million annually, Trump would pay rent starting at $250,000, slowly increasing to $2.775 million over 40 years, what the Wall Street Journal called the tax deal of the century. When the Justice Department filed a discrimination lawsuit in October 1973, after testers proved black applicants were rejected, Fred's fixer advised settling quietly. But Donald, meeting notorious attorney Roy Cohn at Le Club, embraced Cohn's advice. Tell them to go to hell and fight the thing in court. Cohn filed a $100 million countersuit and held press conferences falsely claiming the government wanted to force welfare recipients into Trump buildings. After a year, they settled without admitting guilt, with Donald declaring full satisfaction by reframing defeat as victory. For Trump Tower, Donald acquired air rights from neighboring Tiffany's for $5 million through a handshake deal. Trump Tower opened Valentine's Day 1983, with doormen in tall black fur caps, pianists in the atrium, and rose and peach marble creating endless reflections. Donald relentlessly promoted it, even planting fake stories using his John Barron pseudonym that Prince Charles would live there. The building became his greatest achievement, not because he built it brilliantly, but because he leveraged his father's connections, the city's desperation, and his own shamelessness into a monument defining his public image for decades. Trump's casino ventures paired promotional genius with financial recklessness. After partnering with Holiday Corporation on Trump Plaza, he seized Hilton's failed gaming license in February 1985, negotiating a $320 million deal in 10 days. He funded it with $351.8 million in bonds at 13.75% interest and a $50 million bank loan, putting everything he owned as collateral. Despite promising his Harrah's partner he wouldn't compete, Trump renamed the property Trump Castle, triggering a lawsuit. His ambitions escalated with Resorts International's unfinished Taj Mahal. After warning casino commissioners that banks would have never loaned the money to resorts and calling junk bonds dangerous, Trump issued $675 million in junk bonds at 14% interest, committing to nearly $100 million in annual interest payments. By June 1990, Trump owed $3.4 billion, with casinos drowning under $1.3 billion in debt. After missing $73 million in payments, banks provided a $65 million bailout, but limited Trump to $450,000 monthly. Facing an $18.4 million castle bond payment, Trump executed a scheme. Fred's attorney bought $3.35 million in chips and left without gambling. Donald boasted he'd made the payment independently. It's in the genes. Casino regulators, who captured everything on camera, quietly investigated. The pattern emerged: reckless overleveraging, Fred's rescue, public boasting, and reality visible only to those watching closely. In spring 2002, Mark Burnett rented Trump's Woolman skating rink for a Survivor finale. When Burnett noticed Trump and flattered him, Trump expressed interest in working together. By February 2003, Burnett called expecting a secretary, but reached Trump directly. Unprepared, he pitched, "Survivor, only the jungle is Manhattan." Trump immediately agreed to a 50-50 handshake deal. When Burnett's team arrived at Trump Tower in summer 2003, they were shocked by musty carpets, chipped furniture, and fewer than 50 employees. "Our job was to make him look legitimate," recalled producer Jonathan Brown. The Meet the Billionaire opening used helicopter shots to transform Trump's image, portraying him as a genius who fought back from being billions in debt, showcasing properties he merely licensed rather than owned. The Apprentice averaged 20.7 million viewers its first season, skyrocketing Trump's fame. Success created a new business model, licensing his name to projects others developed. From 2004 to 2010, licensing generated $103.2 million in pure profit, while The Apprentice added $135.2 million. His most lucrative endorsements came from multi-level marketing companies. ACN paid at least $2 million for video phone endorsements, while Trump University sold packages up to $34,995. Burnett didn't just create a hit show. He created the myth that would propel Trump to the presidency. While filming The Apprentice in 2004, Trump defied Fred's explicit wishes to keep the empire intact, directing brother Robert to solicit private bids. Ruby Schron won with $705.6 million, each sibling receiving $177.3 million. Yet buyers' mortgages revealed banks valued the properties at $975 million. The self-proclaimed greatest dealmaker had sold his father's empire for nearly $250 million below its worth. By 2015, Trump's entertainment income had plummeted from $51 million in 2011 to $22 million. He liquidated $98 million in stocks and bonds in January 2014 alone, followed by $54 million in 2015 and $68.2 million in 2016. His business's cash reserves fell 40%. Despite receiving the equivalent of $1.5 billion through Birth, Television Discovery, and forced investments, the stock market would have yielded better returns. Trump has lived his entire adult life in a protective bubble, first financed by his father, then by celebrity fortune. Since abandoning Fred's careful planning, he's waged war on fact-based reality. He told Leslie Stahl he attacked media to discredit you all, so when you write negative stories about me, no one will believe you. The Trump story reveals our collective willingness to mistake confidence for competence. The question isn't whether Trump succeeded or failed. The numbers answer that clearly. It's whether we value reality enough to see through the gold leaf to the hollow core beneath.